You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Swati Khurana. Swati, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I want to talk about your art and as you began and explored many different things, and I know you're also a writer. And you're working on different things now. Could you tell us a little bit about what you are working on right now?
Sure. I don't know if I'm having like a second artistic act, but I am currently getting my MFA in fiction at Hunter College at City University of New York, and I am working on a novel that is set in a print shop in 1940s Lahore. So that's what I'm kind of doing right now. I'm actually in my thesis semester right now, so I should be doing it every minute of the day, but I'm not.
Well, that's a lot of work. How far into the novel are you?
I was about 140 pages in, and then I just had a 40-page amputation, so about 100 pages in.
It is still about the art world, the book. It sounds...
Yes, it's funny. I just in 2013 to 2014, I was a artist in residence at the Center for Book Arts in New York, and it was a fantastic experience. We did started out doing basic letterpress and bookbinding, and I'd never really done letterpress before. We worked with metal and wood type, and I found myself when I was at the print shop, making some work, but just being more excited about watching what people were doing and taking notes and really looking at the machines. And for a few months, I felt guilty that I wasn't making more work because that was pretty much my studio at the time. That was my studio space and studio at the time. And then I realized only much later that I had been researching the entire time.
Hmm. Yeah, it's fascinating, and it's a very interesting way to really be researching. Let's go back a little bit into your first experience with art, because I'd like to trace that a little bit up till now. You're known for working with gender and ethnicity and dealing with rituals after your multi-day Hindu wedding, as you say. Can you tell us a little bit about that and how that did transform I don't know a lot about Hindu weddings. I grew up with a friend who actually had a Hindu wedding, and I remember seeing his images and thinking, oh my God, this looks like, you're the king or something.
Right.
It was amazing.
Yeah. So, just to kind of start there, it was 1998. I was 22 and I got married, and, a lot of people always ask, and I did get married quite young, was it arranged? And my joke is, it was certainly arranged. The wedding, somebody had arranged it, but I married my, longtime high school sweetheart, who was also Indian American like I was. And we'd been together for 6 years, even though we were young, and we got married. And it really was in some ways much more of a family community, my parents' wedding than really my wedding. I decided I wanted to wear maroon in terms of the shade of reds. I picked out a don't playlist for the entertainment DJ. But other than that, I could not have cared less about, arrangements or any of that kind of thing. I was really young. None of my friends were getting married, and I certainly did not. I wasn't really into the rituals. But in many ways, because I didn't plan so much of my wedding, I was observing it. I was observing it as it was happening. I'm the oldest child. I'm also the first one of my entire generation of all my cousins on both sides to get married, and I'm the first one in America to have gotten married. All my family's in India. So it became a very big deal for my family, and it was a large wedding. And I was, highly photographed, highly videotaped. And I just, during the whole time of the wedding, I just felt, I didn't have the language then, but I really felt that it was performance art as it was happening. I felt disembodied. I felt like this isn't really real. This is a spectacle. I'm not really sure what's happening. And I had shown my photographs to a friend of mine who was an editorial assistant at Bridal Guide magazine, which is one of these gigantic magazines for brides that I actually never even looked at because I wasn't really into weddings and brides. And also, they don't ever have anything that's relevant to Indian or Hindu weddings. And she had told me that there was a feature where they published photos of weddings, and they hadn't had an Indian one. So I had asked my mom and my mother-in-law how they felt, and everyone was excited about the idea, and my husband at the time was excited about the idea. So we, you know, gave our photos, and it was published. A two-page spread was published in this magazine called Bridal Guide. And I think the irony of it is, you know, I had my wedding photos published in a gigantic bridal magazine, and I had never even read one up until the until they were published. And I was still very uncomfortable around the ritual. So I made a video in 2000 where I looked at my wedding footage for the first time, but it was through a camera. And so I just kind of recorded the feedback, and it was very mediated. And seeing it all pixelated made sense to me. Seeing it so almost, it looked very tangible, like old archival footage. And then I realized, yes, this is why it was documented. This is what the role of rituals are, especially when you think about immigration of ethnicity and gender. And that's when I started to make work around the wedding. And in 2002, I had actually gone through separation and divorce, which took about a year. And I, again, revisited this footage and photographs, and I started making line drawings of really myself only. I didn't include my ex-husband in them, but just myself as the bride. And I made black and white line drawings and began to then make collages with them. And that work is dated 2005, and it's been probably my most shown work. It first premiered at the Fatal Love exhibition at the Queen's Museum. And in that, I was really interested in how brides and really women are domesticated through the acts of weddings and other rituals.
And that opened up a whole world for you. Where you began writing more about that, and how was that work received? Because that was when you began having more shows after.
Right. I mean, 2005 was, when I'd started, I had previously made documentary videos in the late 90s that were collaborative and then some short experimental videos. And I would say 2005 was the beginning of when I was making work that could, you know, go on the wall, that was a little bit, and it was shown quite a bit more. One incredibly important aspect of both that work and my own development as an artist and what really nurtured me is an organization that I was a founding member of called SASCI, the South Asian Women's Creative Collective in New York. And it was founded in 1997. And at the time that it was being founded, I was, you know, experimenting with poetry and experimental video and documentary. I wasn't making the kind of work I was making later. But it was really essential place for me because it provided a home in which I could explore all of these ideas, you know, gender and ethnicity, and specifically looking at Indian wedding garments and rituals to an audience where I didn't have to explain the significance and the symbolism of a lot of things, so I could actually get deeper into the material, I could get deeper into the content, and deeper critically as well. And that helped me so much because it gave me a lot of, I think, confidence just in showing my work outside of that kind of community, and also, frankly, exposure, because that organization had guest curators and annual shows, and I was in a good number of them, a few of them, certainly, and just meeting other artists, other South Asian artists, gave me an entire way of thinking about, you know, how do you create a life, how do you create an artistic life and an artistic identity.
And you were very active, it seems, on in getting shows around that time, right? You were in a lot of group shows. You were an AIM artist, which was, must have been a great experience as well. Was that a time of particular activity because you were
Yes, certainly. So in throughout that time, right before the Fatal Love exhibition, I had gone to graduate school, and I went to a program at NYU called at the Gallatin School of Individualized Study. I was working at NYU at the time, and so I was pretty young. I was 23, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. As I said, I was making these experimental videos. It was the dot-com era. I thought maybe I should get involved in that and make some money. I didn't know what I was doing. And this program allowed me to take courses throughout the divisions at NYU. So I took, you know, web design classes. I took film theory. I did all kinds of things. I wasn't really in a cohort. I was kind of just on my own taking classes. And it was at the around 2000, 2001 that I realized I think I might want to try this thing called studio art and working towards a studio practice. And I took a semester in Venice through a master's program that was at NYU that I was kind of able to transfer into for the summer, and I worked with Angela Churchill and Maurizio Pellegrin, and that's when I first started to make installations. I started to look at my videos in other ways, you know, not just in terms of documentaries and them being screened at festivals, but also in terms of environments, in terms of in a more visual art way. And right after that, I just started sending out applications wildly, and I got into the Artists in the Marketplace program at the Bronx Museum AIM, and I had my first residency at the Henry Street Settlement. And through all of these programs, the most important thing for me, especially because I didn't have a traditional art grad school experience, I didn't have an MFA, I didn't have a shared studio space, I didn't have open studio, I didn't have anything like that. What all these residency programs did for me was almost give me the grad school experience outside of grad school, and where I just met artists, who many of whom I'm still friends with, you know, 10 years later. And I think artists really connect. We connect each other to shows and opportunities. I mean, back then, this was, you know, 2000. You're, you know, running to Chelsea or Babu and making your 24-hour slides and printing out slide labels and just sending them out. And I would say probably the first 5 to 7 years of that part of my career, I was sending out a lot of applications, a lot of calls for submissions, and just trying to, you know, meet people, get into programs where I could meet people, be part of group exhibitions. And I think, you know, in some way, I mean, I got rejected from a whole lot more than I ever could have done, but it was definitely, you know, being in New York was great, being part of SASI, the South Asian Women's Group, was great, but it was also just a lot of sending your materials out and seeing what happens, seeing who responds to, you know, what you're working on.
Well, it sounds like you also built a group of friends through that. I mean, that's such an important point, and I've been hearing it more and more lately, but through the nonprofits and also all the open calls, you're building, it sounds like to me you're saying you built really a support group of friends.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing is that, you know, if you decide to kind of embark on a creative world, whether, you know, right now I'm doing more writing than visual art at the moment, but whether you're doing art, writing, music, anything, and especially acting, you're dealing a lot with putting yourself out there and getting rejected. I mean, that's happening. I mean, at least for me, it happened a lot more than other things. And it's your friends, and it's your, you know, just working with people that you can really talk to, run ideas by. I mean, I just had friends where if I was really disappointed about something, they would remind me of, you know, a few really great things that had just happened that I might have forgotten about. And I think friends, my friends particularly were just so encouraging and steady and unwavering their support, and I hope that I was to them as well. And I think that that's really what gave me the stamina to, you know, do this for 2 decades and ongoing, to hopefully more, and gave me the context and the support, because this wasn't something that was easy for me to do. I didn't have many models coming from an immigrant background where my parents were, you know, were far more sensible. My father's a physician, and I had the idea for a long time that, hey, I might just end up going to law school. I never did that. And really trying to figure out how do you make a creative life and sustain a creative life.
Right. And you figured it out, which is remarkable, as you're saying, with the help of your friends, and you continue to evolve. Are you going to still have exhibitions, or do you think you may only be doing writing in the future?
Well, you know, the funny thing with exhibitions is that their timeline is so different. So 2 years ago, I started writing more full-time, and partly that happened, you know, like I said, I just had this great moment when I was at the Center for Book Arts, feeling so inspired by the machines and thinking, wow, this existed 50 years ago, this existed 100 years ago, and it allowed me to imaginatively time travel in a way, because I'd always wanted to write about colonial India, but didn't know how I could do that, and then I could. I was pregnant, and I had a child, you know, 4 years ago, and that's when I had to leave my shared studio in Brooklyn, partially because of, you know, all the chemicals that other people use, and physically it was just getting hard for me to get to the studio with some things that I was kind of personally going through at the time. And it made me definitely think about, you know, what is my creative life now. And one of the things I started to do, which I do very regularly, actually, I just did it at the University of Illinois Chicago a couple months ago, and this is kind of one of my post-studio projects, is I have a project called Texting Scrolls, and where I made a kind of table cigarette girl-style tray that I wear around my neck. And I look at people share their intimate text messages with me. Often strangers are sharing messages with me. And then I transcribe them onto translucent vellum and roll them up and give it back to them as scrolls. And I photographed the exchange so I can reproduce the text messages, which I've done. I just had an installation at the Queens Museum and the Center for Book Arts, a wall vinyl installation with some of the found text. And I've done this a couple times at the Dumbo Arts Festival. And what I've found myself really interested in, you know, in this not having a regular studio, is that I'm realized that what drove me to making art in the first place many years ago when I was doing all this community-based work is public engagement. And so right now I'm not operating really within a gallery system. I just had a commission through the Schomburg for an embroidery that was just shown for the 40th anniversary of Antisakashange. One of my collaborative projects called Unsuitable Girls is on view at the Smithsonian, the Indians in America Beyond Bollywood exhibition for a year. So I'm really interested in continuing to make artwork that's publicly engaged, that's very accessible, and that operates within institutions that are also poised to operate in the public interest. So museums, libraries, streets. I participated in the Art and Out Places Festival on 14th Street, and that's the kind of thing I'm interested in rather than the more gallery market-based art world.
Right, and what else do you do? Do you plan on, do you teach or do you do more things?
Yeah, the way I've survived all these years, and, you know, I'm getting my second graduate degree now on the cusp of 40, is 17 years ago, I started tutoring for the SAT and doing college prep kind of work, and it's been very cool. I've been working for the same company for 17 years. It's allowed me to, at times maintain a studio, go away for residencies in the summer, and work on projects and have a bit of flexibility with my schedule that I can schedule. So I've had a kind of a steady part-time teaching gig, the same gig for about 17 years. And I find that that's really allowed me, probably among, other than having a strong community of friends, having a fairly steady stream of employment that with some level of flexibility has probably been the single biggest factor in my being able to have a creative life in New York City.
Absolutely. That's very important. It's been wonderful talking to you. In closing, people will hear this month, so there's some of your work that they may be able to see. Is there anything you want to leave with artists who are probably thinking, wow, she, you know, has done so much and seems to have a wonderful life as an artist? Is there any, words of encouragement in any way you want to leave the artist?
Sure. I think, you know, I really think that for me, it's really about I mean, I just have to say, the one thing for me is community. And, you know, it's through community. And some people say, is it community or is it networking? And I think if it's authentic, it's the same thing. I mean, you know, going and supporting your friends, going to their, you know, going to their openings, checking out your friends' studios, things they're working on, and figuring out, you know, what it is that you're interested in. I mean, for me, I went to a lot of open studios for a lot of different residency programs before I applied to them to see, you know, could I see myself here? Could I see my work here? And but in addition to doing that research that we all do online, I think as much as possible, and I know it's hard in, you know, 2015 when everything is so virtual, I think the in-person can really matter a lot too. There's just certain conversations you can have, you know, in person. And I think, you know, if you're interested in different artists and things that they're working on, I mean, so much of my education was just people coming to my studio and talking to me and me going to other people's studios and talking to them.
Swathi, thank you so much for talking with us today.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIVC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.